Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I are joined by Jonathan Rosenberg to discuss his recent paper entitled Psychedelics and the Pursuit of Human Flourishing, an examination of research and potential psychological mechanisms. John is a consultant for Numinous and recently defended this paper as his capstone project for his Master's of Applied Positive Psychology at the prestigious University of Pennsylvania. John helps Reed and I explore the concept of human flourishing, self-transcendence, self-distancing, spiritual intelligence, meaning-making, compassion, beginner's mind, and several other topics related to the potential that psychedelic tools have for helping people heal, grow, and flourish, especially when those tools are used to assist the psychotherapy process. A couple of announcements for you before we get into the show. If you're looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, check out Numinous's training programs. You can click the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. You've heard Reed and myself reference our work on clinical trials a lot on the show. We have a number of trials actively recruiting participants, including the Compass Pathways psilocybin trial, investigating the combination of psilocybin and the Compass Psychological Support Model for treatment-resistant depression. You can click the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more. Folks, this is usually the point in the interview where I ask you to leave us a rating or review. Thank you to those of you who have done that already. If you haven't, and you're a listener to the show, please take the time now to do so, if you're willing, of course. This sends a signal to our algorithmically inclined robot overlords that our show is worth listening to and increases the chances that more people like you will find it. And now I bring you our conversation with John Rosenberg. Welcome back, everybody, to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. Reed and I are very pleased to be joined by John Rosenberg today to talk about his capstone paper and project entitled Psychedelics and the Pursuit of Human Flourishing. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing great, and it's such a pleasure to be here. Longtime listener, and I wrote this capstone, and we'll get into it, but thinking that if you can change your beliefs, then you can change your life and you can change the world. And that's kind of the underlying idea of what I want to be sharing today.
I love that. You know, because you're a listener to the show, you've probably heard Reed and I talk a lot about this idea of not believing everything you think and how these entrenched, old, corrosive beliefs that we get attached to can, you know, we can attribute a lot of our suffering to the attachment to those beliefs. So I'm excited to talk to you today about what you learned in this deep research and maybe what some of the recommendations you have for our listeners are in the pursuit of human flourishing.
Amazing.
Yeah, I love that intro, John. That was inspiring. We could just end it right there. But you know what? What comes up for me is, this idea of psychedelic meaning mind manifesting. And with all the disclaimers that we focus on here about also don't believe every vision you see on psychedelics, cutting through all that, psychedelics are truth tellers within yourself, like in the spirit of knowing yourself. There's not much that will put a screen in front of you like that and show you what you need to work on like psychedelics. And I'm sure we'll get into that, but that's just what comes to mind right when you shared your opening thoughts.
Well, John, could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I've been in the corporate world for a very long time, doing lots of different things. And when some folks hit midlife crisis, they decide to buy a car or, you know, a beach house. I decided to go back to school and do a master's in applied positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania with Dr. Marty Seligman, who you were talking about just a few weeks ago. As I was kind of diving into what human flourishing is, which is kind of at the core of this idea of positive psychology, I just got fascinated by the impact that psychedelics might have on it. And I've been working with Numinous now for a couple of years as a consultant. I work in many different projects, and it's just, there's a deep connection that I feel with the world of psychedelics. And I just thought my work could kind of dig in a little bit into understanding what are some of the psychological mechanisms, because, you know, there's a lot of work yet to do in the world of psychedelics.
Yeah. So cool that you got to work with Seligman and, David Yeadon, some of these big names in both positive psychology and human flourishing and psychedelic research.
Yeah. Good midlife crisis choices, Jonathan.
I was going to say what was very interesting to me, and I didn't really know what I was getting myself into when I started this, like many of us do, you know, when we're searching for meaning or searching for something bigger. And what really struck a chord for me on positive psychology is that we spend a lot of our lives trying to bring ourselves from, call it minus 10 to zero, to this like neutral level. And this notion that we can go from zero to plus 10, that we can thrive, that we can flourish, that we can grow and transcend, for me, it was just very, very powerful. And I think post-pandemic, where the word languishing became so popular, this idea of flourishing just resonated very powerfully with me.
Yeah, I like the way you make the distinction between what you might call clinical psychology and positive psychology, right? So I'm a clinical psychologist. That's what my degree is in. And yeah, in graduate school, we focused a lot on that minus 10 to zero process. You know, how do human minds and psyches get to minus 10? What labels do we have for those different ways that people get so-called mentally ill, and how can we bring them back to baseline? But, you know, human flourishing sounds like it's a different focus, even though there is an overlap, right? It's not like two circles. I imagine there's a Venn diagram where they overlap.
Yeah. So one of the analogies that they use in the program that I found very powerful is this idea of having a reversible cape. On one side is green and on the other side is red. The red side is the one that, you know, focuses on, when you wear that one, you're focused on fixing problems. The green side, you're focused on how to grow things, how to make them better, how to improve them, how to, you know, on progress. So although there's, to your point, Steve, there's lots of overlap, there's a very important difference between the two. And most of what we're going to talk about today, I think it's important to make a disclaimer, is focus on that going from zero to 10. I'm not a clinician, so my work is focused on performance and thriving and growth. And that's kind of the intent of what I wanted to add to the field when I wrote this paper.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting, I don't know if it's a dilemma, but just something I've tried to make a distinction between in my own practice is, you know, psychotherapy is typically deployed to help people who have a diagnosed mental health condition, right? And certainly people come into therapist's office for the problems of human flourishing all the time. But you'll often find people who are looking for growth outside of the context of a diagnosed mental health condition, seeing a coach. So you've got sort of this therapy industry and coaching industry, and sometimes therapists like to crap on coaches and coaches like to crap on therapists. But again, I think there's a lot of overlap, and I don't know that we really need to be territorial, but sometimes when I've got somebody who maybe doesn't meet diagnostic criteria for a particular mental health condition or mental illness, and they've got some goals, how they want to go from zero to 10, then we'll create a coaching container instead of a therapy container. And it's a relevant conversation because psychedelics right now are being studied for how they can assist or accelerate the psychotherapy process. Although there are people all over the world using psychedelics who don't probably have diagnosable mental health conditions for this purpose of personal development.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's one of the big questions that I ask on my paper is, you know, what does therapy or coaching look like for folks who are using psychedelics? So maybe we can kind of jump into it and talk a little bit about what the paper, kind of what the thesis or the hypothesis that I'm working with in the paper is. And if you think about it, it's kind of like a five-step process. The first step is you know, the substance, right? The medicine, whether you call it, you know, psilocybin or you call it MDMA or whatever it is that that substance is. And what the second step is what that generates. And I would say my advisor, David Yaden, who you mentioned earlier, who was very kind to help me with this project, he's done a lot of work in self-transcendent experiences, which is that second step. And I think there's numerous definitions to self-transcendent experiences, but they include warmth and connectedness and the sense of lightness and egolessness or ego dissolution, timelessness, love, compassion, joy, freedom, wonder. And psychologist, or I don't know if we could call him a psychologist, maybe a philosopher, William James in 1902 was kind of the first one who started kind of really focusing on this through mystical experiences in his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. So there's been a lot more research done on what self-transcendent experiences are. And sometimes they can be generated by psychedelics. And we know that psychedelics can generate those consistently for a lot of folks, but there are other ways to achieve that, like mindfulness and awe, and some say near-death experiences or sensory deprivation, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of like the second step. The third step is self-distancing. And I think I'm going to put a little pin on it and we can maybe deep dive into that one. The fourth one is belief change, which is kind of how I kicked off the podcast with this idea that if we change our beliefs, we can change ourselves and then we can change the world. And then the last one is human flourishing, which is achieved through this kind of, and it's not a straight line, Stephen Reed, like it's, you know, like progress, as we know, can be quite convoluted. So that's the general notion of the paper.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you cite people like Viktor Frankl and Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow. And I saw that in your acknowledgments of the paper, you mentioned Scott Kaufman, these people that have written about and talked about and researched and worked on this concept of transcendence, of self-transcendence. And it goes by a variety of names, right? Self-actualization, transcendence. So I guess I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I am so curious about what that actually looks like. So when we say flourishing or transcendence or actualization, what are we talking about?
What a great question. And to your point, I think folks who study it, there's different definitions. Maslow, to your point, talked about altruism and spirituality and connectedness. And Frankl talked about, you know, the experiences that we live, like loving others, the actions that we take, like doing something significant or meaningful for the world, and then the attitudes that we take. So meaning making, Frankl, you know, Holocaust survivor, definitely, you know, when you read Man's Search for Meaning, you certainly see how meaning had such a powerful impact on the experience that he endured. And interestingly enough, I recently recovered my, I'm a descendant of Holocaust survivors, and I recently recovered my my Austrian citizenship, which my grandfather lost right before or right during the Second World War, and took my two kids, my wife, my mother, and my nieces went to Vienna to uncover a stone of remembrance for my family who died in the concentration camps. And, you know, so I think I've explored this idea of transcendence or other folks' transcendence through my own experience. And I think exploring that intergenerational trauma was my way to transcend that moment in my family, in my history.
Wow. That's a powerful example. And I was going to ask how you view the difference between self-transcendence or the link between self-transcendence and self-actualization. And then just for fun, if you have a guess on what percent of the world is self-actualized, it's just a curiosity I always have.
I would have to do like a consulting case study to try and come up with a percentage there. I would say it's a privilege to achieve self-actualization of self-transcendence. And as a lot more of our basic needs are being met, I guess more folks can access that space, right? We have to worry a little bit less about hunting and gathering and a little bit more about exploring ourselves and you know. So I don't know, Reed, what a great question. Maybe 15%, 20%. I'm just throwing a number out there. I have no idea. And it's interesting because even in populations that we may assume have less access to stuff, quote unquote, or to luxuries or to technology, we see a lot of self-transcendence in those populations as well. So it's a very difficult question to answer. So I literally just threw a number out of thin air. So
yeah.
Hope that helps.
Yeah. And then, like, do you think self-transcendent experiences are a prerequisite, a course accelerator? You know, how do you view them in the self-actualization journey?
Yeah, I think they're certainly essential for as a part of psychedelic therapy, or at least that's what the evidence seems to indicate so far. And that I may very well be, you know, disproved in the coming years. But so far, there's a lot of evidence to support the notion that the subjective experience has a big impact on the positive outcomes that psychedelics generate. So I think yes.
So, you know, we were talking about whether or not these self-transcendent experiences are essential or necessary. And it makes me think of some of the companies that are trying to produce psychedelic drugs that don't give you the psychedelic experience, right? Hoping that that'll still lead to some neuroplasticity or some kind of therapeutic benefit, but you wouldn't have that phenomenological lived experience of self-transcendence.
Yeah, I think it seems from the literature and from the research that I've done, it seems like this is core to the positive outcomes. Now, it is possible, like everything in science, that it will change over time. However, I think for now, what we know, based on the on what the researchers are telling us, is that the subjective experience has a significant impact on the beneficial outcomes of psychedelics.
I was just going to make reference to those five steps that John talked about earlier, and you put a pin in the, I think, the self-distancing step. So maybe this would be a good time to return to that and talk about what that means.
Yeah. And this is a concept that, so originally I was trying to work with identity. And identity is a very difficult concept to pin down. And as I was researching identity, I came across to this notion of self-distancing. And it has many different names in the literature. Some folks call it distancing, or decentering is how it's called in meditation or mindfulness literature. Some other folks call it psychological distance. And it's basically this notion of feeling like a fly on the wall, that you can see what is happening to you from a third party standpoint. There's a certain objectivity that comes with self-distancing. Now, when we think about psychedelic journeys, you can transcend to the point where you kind of get lost, right? In this notion of self-distancing, there's still an anchor in your lived experience, right? So now let's use an example, maybe, because I think that will help illustrate the point. If you're very much in the moment, and folks like to use the word triggered these days, right? Like you're activated, or you're, you know, you have very little distance from your emotions and your thoughts. What I'm exploring in my project is that this self-transcendence can be, it correlates in a way with self-distancing, which is looking at a current specific moment in your life from a third party viewpoint. So if you've always said, I'm an alcoholic, let's say if you have an alcohol use disorder and you've always said, I'm an alcoholic, and you're in this place where you're constantly thinking, I'm an alcoholic. And it's like a pattern and a belief that repeats itself. Self-distancing allows you to move away from that and say, describe yourself from a third party perspective and say, well, I am a person who consumes alcohol, or I'm a person who consumes too much alcohol, or I'm a person who has an alcohol abuse disorder, but it doesn't define you as a person. And the moment that self-distancing occurs, then there's this moment that opens up. You had Gul Dolan on the podcast recently, and she talks about critical learning periods, right? So I wonder if there's some sort of correlation there where you actually get to make a decision and say, well, if I'm not an alcoholic, but I'm a person who drinks a lot of alcohol or a person who has an alcohol abuse disorder, I can also be a person who can drink less alcohol or who can find other ways of. So that's the general notion of self-distancing.
You know, the term has always troubled me a bit, I'll just admit, and a little bit of a rant, because self-distancing is a positive thing, right? If you get into the definition, but it, I think in many triggers or activates a dissociation idea. But you know what helps me conceptualize it is like why it's helpful. Like, there was this one study out of Harvard that was, it showed self-distancing versus our typical reaction of avoidance is what actually mediates the difference between being mindful or being caught up in an emotional struggle. Like, and I like to, like, if I think of self-distancing, see it as what Ram Dass might call like being in the world or not of the world, or others would say slipping into that observer seat or equanimity. Like, can you hold it all? Versus, so it's not a bypassing, it's not a numbing or avoiding or dissociating. I just wanted to clarify.
I love that, Reed. And I think to your point, it's a matter of degrees, right? I think if you distance too far, right, you might find yourself in that dissociated place, right? If you distance just enough, what they call the Aristotelian mean or the golden mean, finding that right balance, which is why I believe, mm-hmm. based on the research and what I've read, why the therapeutic component is so essential to the use of psychedelics in a healing environment or for healing purposes. Because you need that guidance, you need that space, that safe container where you can explore that.
This is just a curiosity, but you know how sometimes there are these really striking, tragic cases sometimes of unchecked, high dose, solo, frequent psychedelic use leading to someone kind of going off the deep end, and not just a spiritual emergency, but like a destabilized, ego inflated, out of touch with reality state. And I wonder, like what you said about you don't want to distance too far or too long. I wonder what the potential link there is or the mechanism, because, you know, doing all this distancing or dissociating or transcending even without, like you said, that therapeutic home base, ground control, checks and balance can be risky.
Yeah, so I would say, I think there is, I'm concerned to use the word consensus, but I'll use it just for the sake of this conversation.
Yeah, bold move for a scientist to use the word consensus.
but I say there, generally, well, there's, let's not call it consensus. Good point, Steve. But there's generally, there are a lot of folks who agree that the preparation and integration phases are essential. And most of the studies that we've seen with psychedelics include therapeutic support. Now, there's no standard, approach to what that therapeutic support looks like yet. And that kind of leads me to answer your question, Reed, into kind of the future directions piece of my work, which is around what does that therapy look like in order for people to feel like they are benefiting from the psychedelic assisted therapy. So there are 6 points that I touch on. Number one is trust. And it's this idea of that there's a sense of safety and openness and the connection with the inner healer that happens through the therapist or the person that's working with you. The second one is creating ethical guidelines and codes of conduct. So what does that look like in the future? What are the competencies? What's the integrity expectations, the intentions, service to society, financial compensation? What are all of these things that are included in somebody who leads folks on psychedelic therapy, harm reduction, and simply defined, this is just about diminishing adverse consequences for the client. And then this notion, number four, I'm on number four, it's this notion of client therapy medicine fit. So there's no one size fits all, right? So each client might need a different type of medicine or a different type of therapeutic approach. So is there a matrix that we can create that allows us to scale therapy? Because the big question here is, how do we scale this? How do we, if we know it's safe, if we know it can help people, then how do we get as many people as we can access to psychedelic assisted therapy? So I think these are some of the questions that we need to answer. Number five is the question of firsthand experience, whether therapy, you know, psychedelic assisted therapy guides need to have firsthand experience or not. And there's lots of ethical questions there. Happy to jump on that rabbit hole, although I'm probably not the best person to speak on that. And the last one, which to me, it had a tremendous impact, and it's because of the reason, and I'll share a little bit about my story on how I fell into this work, but it's this idea of spiritual intelligence. So having self-awareness, understanding self-transcendent experiences and what they mean, this notion of eudaimonia, which you spoke about on a recent podcast, this idea of helping others, this notion of other people matter, and how do I get off the hedonic treadmill, this, you know, world of hedonism, and into sharing my experience with the world, and meaning making, which can be a very difficult thing during the integration phase for a lot of folks who've been interviewed.
So that is a excellent list. And I forgive me, I'm forgetting, it's a list of what? The things that make psychedelic assisted therapy helpful? I'm sorry, I lost track.
I think these are some of the things, the ones that when I came across the literature, these are some of the things that we need to explore in depth and truly understand in order to scale psychedelic assisted therapy. That's kind of how I see it. That's my perception.
So I think, you know, like I said, excellent list. And I agree with you that we need a lot more research on the items and many others, but certainly the items that you listed, in order to scale psychedelic therapy in a way that makes it accessible and precise. You know, I think I said on the podcast recently that precision psychedelic medicine we're not quite there yet, right? We don't quite have that yet. We've got a lot of studies right now that suggest that things like psilocybin are pretty good for depression, or at least better than placebo. Maybe even better than, you know, standard treatment like antidepressants and regular old therapy. It is interesting to see in the MAPS trials that while the results are incredible, that a lot of people in the comparison group got a lot better too. And these are supposedly people who had already, you know, basically had so-called treatment-resistant PTSD, right? People who'd been through a lot of treatment. So it does go to show that what we're already doing can be helpful for people. And also that the phrase that we use to describe this work, psychedelic assisted therapy, I think is fairly appropriate, that psychedelics can really enhance what we are already doing and maybe help make those changes that are made in therapy more durable. And perhaps they're more durable because of what you're talking about, this lived experience of self-transcendence and self-distancing, like Reed described, not to the extent that we dissociate or we avoid, but to the extent that we are given a new vantage point from which to view our problems so that we de-identify with those problems. We no longer act from this place where we are what our labels suggest we are.
And, you know, it's not just, in my opinion, a self-development tool. It also is kind of one of the mechanisms by which we can keep the others' perspective in mind too, and have a lot of empathy in action by this like state of a self-distancing kind of awareness where you can see multiple sides of the coin as you go through these situations. But I wanted to also, on a semi-related note, highlight something you said, Jonathan, about spiritual intelligence, because I that's a current rabbit hole, a favorite rabbit hole of mine. And I think even the flourishing, while it gets there, we're not talking enough about like spiritual intelligence, spiritual development, practically speaking, because we're all debating religions and walking on eggshells and so many other reasons. But there's one thing that I came across recently I wanted to just read. It was 6 questions to calculate your level of self in a spiritual intelligence. I think it's by O'Donnell. There's a lot of people working on this. He was in favor of focusing on both rational intelligence, emotional, and the spiritual intelligence missing piece. But number one is like, how much time, money, and energy and thoughts do we need to obtain a desired result? How much bilateral respect is there in our relationships? That one I love. How clean a game we play with others. Like, do you cheat when you can get away with it? Things like that. How much dignity do we retain in respecting the dignity of others? How tranquil we remain in spite of the workload? How sensible our decisions are? How stable we remain in upsetting situations? And how easily we see virtues instead of defects. So those 6 things I think are pretty cool to take an inventory of self on. I just wanted to throw that in.
You know, it's a relief to hear those 6 things and to know that that my friends and colleagues, the Robisons, are spiritually intelligent gentlemen, because we were playing pickleball the other day and it was like, was that out? No, I think that was out. I think you guys have that point. There was lots of good relationship building and playing cleanly. I appreciate that, Reed.
Yeah, that was fun, Steve. Jonathan, you got to fly out here from Canada and we'll play some pickleball. Fly out again.
I'm looking forward. Pickleball is all the rage. Yeah. And Reed, I was just saying, and I think it was the second question. Can you go back to the second question you just brought up?
How much bilateral respect exists in your relationships?
I love that. That's really powerful. And I also, you know, thinking about respect as you know, as a low bar for relationships, right? One of the interesting things that I learned through my positive psychology experience was I think you can summarize everything that I learned in 3 words. And this is Chris Peterson who came up with this. He said, other people matter. And how we connect with other people makes all the difference in our own lives and in their lives. There's so many studies that talk about, you know, how positive social connections reduce mortality and do all different things. And that was the inspiration for this project. For me, was the loss of a very dear friend to cancer that pushed me to explore these more deeply, because I think there's a lot of suffering out there as well that we need to address and that we need to find a way to help other folks through it.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about. Like we're interpersonal beings. We exist kind of to interbe, or we're wired to connect, and that's a source of so many of our struggles, like wars and conflict and triggered in relationship. Then it's the source of so much comfort and joy. And then, like on this spectrum, as you become more spiritually intelligent and self-actualized and all that, you embody this do no harm, or you're keeping others, even nature, in mind as you move through life. It's kind of a beautiful big picture to look at.
Yeah, you know, I've been diving back into the happiness research. I'm currently reading Arthur Brooks's book, Build the Life You Want, The Art and Science of Getting Happier. And it always amazes me when I revisit this stuff that the idioms and adages and aphorisms that have been around for hundreds, likely thousands of years about happiness and human flourishing seem so basic, right? You find them in just about every world religion. You find them in just about every self-development guru's list of, you know, top 10 list of becoming happier. And they almost always include this idea of other people matter, right? The so-called 7 deadly sins involve a lot of things that that are self-absorbed, right? Greed and envy and gluttony and lust and all those things. When it's about us, we're much more likely to suffer. And when I think about the turmoil that the global community is experiencing, that the American national community is experiencing, a lot of it is, you often hear the word tribal, right? At least to evoke this notion that people are fighting, right? That we are othering other people. They aren't like us. We're afraid of them. We're going to treat them poorly. And, sometimes I think if we could have a global psychedelic experience, if it was just aerosolized in the air and we were all in it together, that we might come out on the other end with this truth that other people matter and we should act on it.
Yeah, and I think that's where self-actualization falls short. I know it's up for debate. There is not absolute consensus, but to me, I think self-actualization misses, like it achieves one potential, but it misses the kind of the spiritual kind of virtue and ethics part of the equation and the taking care of each other fully and the planet, things like that. But just my two cents.
Yeah, and I think some researchers would make a distinction between self-actualization, which is more self-focus, and self-transcendent, which is more other-focus, mm-hmm. I would say. I would say, for me, a personal self-transcendence moment was, like many of us, I grew up with the values of, money, power, reputation as this kind of North Stars that if we achieve them, then we will be happy and we will be fulfilled. And then once you have your basic needs covered, you kind of start to wonder, is this really it? What will more money do for me? What will power do for me? And, self-determination theory talks about, I don't know, maybe this is my own connection, but this notion of replacing the value of money with the value of mastery, of being really good at your craft, right? Of being, and that will bring money for most folks, right? But it's more other focused than money, which is all about my bank account, right? And then replacing power with this notion of autonomy, which is the ability to make your own decisions and move forward in the way that you believe it's best, and retaining that autonomy, which is a powerful motivator for many of us. And then replacing this want for reputation, which today we see a lot on the, social media influencers, et cetera, with relatedness, which is that true deep human connection in which we are kind of having a moment where we can see other people for who they really are, right? As opposed to for what they can do for us.
Yeah, so we're here on this planet for who knows what reason, right? And maybe it's to learn and grow and figure some of this stuff out, right? And we all are kind of growing up as we go, physically, emotionally, mentally, hopefully spiritually. Some people may have a really spiral trajectory. It's never linear, but just thinking out loud here of like psychedelics for many people, and in my experience, accelerate the path of waking up and growing up on all these fronts, like emotionally and spiritually. And even like you could argue physically from an embodiment standpoint and the way you connect to your own body. So just another thing that your thesis work and the discussion is bringing to mind.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the body, because a lot of I think we've all followed Roland Griffith's story and his diagnosis, and we've seen he's certainly one of the researchers that lit the spark of the modern psychedelic renaissance, and when you look at his interviews and the way in which he's facing a pretty grim prognosis, there's a certain hope and a certain optimism that he communicates that, at least for me, it's been incredibly moving to hear him tell his own story. And express the amount of gratitude, to your point, Reed, that he has for, you know, those fleeting moments that we have in this planet. So that's, yeah, it's a powerful insight. What did you say, Steve? Aerosol psychedelics?
Yeah, and those moments exist without the spray can of psychedelics. Like I'm remembering in Denver at the MAPS conference when Roland Griffiths gave his speech, I think on the last morning, and he's gets up from his wheelchair in at the back of the stage. He stands up and just musters up the strength to deliver this touching speech, starts crying with... is overcome by love and gratitude by the standing ovation. And I think everyone felt the aerosolized psychedelic love in the air in that moment. And he had done something to self-transcend, self-distance from the body, and keep his perspective of like love and gratitude and appreciation for life that is also inspiring.
Yeah, and for many of us who were in the audience, that was a moment of self-transcendence, right? Of seeing the world in a different light and transcending the ego and you know, this self-centered notion that, you know, it's all about me, which we see quite a bit around us these days.
Instead of we're all just walking each other home.
Love it.
Yeah, you know, I've noticed this a lot in my practice because a lot of people, several of my clients, you mentioned midlife crisis, John, sort of at the beginning, are people who have been following the so-called American dream, and they were working on personal power development, accumulation of wealth, and they had relationships in tow. But once they have some of those needs met or they've checked those boxes, they find themselves unfulfilled. And almost to a person, one of the things they find themselves striving for is connection, is mastery, is meaning and purpose. But most of it is like, I want to make a difference. I'm done being a stockbroker. You know, I'm done being an oil mogul. I want to help people. I want to make a difference in the lives of others. And then they'll tell me that when they can get past the personal barriers and start doing that kind of work, that it's much more meaningful than the kind of work that made them millionaires.
It's so powerful and so common, Steve, and I see it all the time as well. I went through that experience, right? It was, you know, I finally had my dream job, and that was the moment when I realized I was burning out, and what's the point of all of this? And it's part of what pushed me to work with Numinous and work in the industry, because I believe that. Yeah, psychedelics are not a panacea and they're not going to solve all of the world's problems. And yet they're an incredibly powerful tool in the toolbox to help people connect and to help people overcome their challenges and flourish and find ways to maximize their potential on this earth while we're here, right? How can we leave a trail of you know, good behind us, and ripples of well-being, if you want to call them.
I love that. Ripples of well-being sounds like a great name for a song or
a like it. Bring out the guitar.
Yeah.
So Steve, you were talking about people, having this experience that we're noticing more and more of, like giving back or going beyond the ego. And John, you mentioned like the, you know, more than money, it's mastery and a sense of purpose. But Steve, wondering if you think this is like Erickson's stages of adult development in action that we're witnessing, of those, like you go through your identity, your intimacy development, then generativity in your 40 to age 65 range. I'm just intrigued by these different theories of adult development and what psychedelics can do, like I was saying, to help us accelerate the path and get to the positive sides of the coin of each phase.
Yeah, I often wonder what these stages of adult development that have been developed are attributable to, and I wonder how universal they are. Like, would we see the same stages 100,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago? Are they somewhat a symptom of modern, perhaps capitalist-based societies? or other biochemical reasons, right? You know, in a man, for instance, when testosterone drops, is he less ambitious and self-absorbed and, you know, calms down enough to pay attention to the people around him, right? So lots of interesting thoughts, but to your point, Reid, I have noticed that when using psychedelic tools, it tends to move people through perhaps certain stages of development rapidly. If you have this sort of chemical perspective enhancement, and again, citing John's work here, that helps you get distance from and transcend these old modes of being, these old habits of belief, to see things from a different perspective. And with that, you can really forge a new life, hopefully calibrated to meaning and purpose. When you were talking about those things, it made me think of Daniel Pink's book, Drive. I can't remember how old that book is, but I really liked it when it came out. And he talks about three key components of intrinsic motivation, and they are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So I think very, very consistent with what you're talking about here, John.
Yeah, and you also mentioned Steve Arthur Brooks, and he talks about, you know, fluid versus crystallized intelligence, and this notion how our brain function changes as we, you know, hit 35 and then on. That first we have this you know, fluid intelligence, that it's about acquiring knowledge and applying that knowledge really quickly, and then it shifts into crystallized intelligence, which I would say it's a little bit more like wisdom, right? And this idea of understanding a situation a little bit different, and using that wisdom to move forward, and how, you know, now that our life expectancy is higher, I believe we're living in the golden age of humanity. You know, life expectancy has never been higher. Infant mortality has never been lower. Literacy has never been higher. So when you think about it, that we have these long lives, and what are we going to do? You know, we spend the first half of our lives trying to be safe and trying to, quote unquote, survive. What are we going to do with the second half of our lives, and how do we make a very meaningful impact as a result of that? And, you know, another, by the way, I saw Arthur Brooks speak not too long ago, and he had this analogy that was, he really stuck with me. He says that, you know, in the West, we tend to see the world like a blank canvas, and we're just adding painting and more painting to it. And we think that the more we add, the better it's going to look. You know, it's our masterpiece. And in the East, they look at it as a piece of jade, and you start chiseling away instead of adding. So how does he call it? It's a not a bucket list, but a bucket don't do list kind of thing. I don't want a budget, but it's this idea of what are the things that we can take away from our life in order to really appreciate and value those things that we have and show gratitude for those.
Yeah, like an unbucket list. I think I heard him talk about
list. Yes,
something like that. Yeah,
unbucket
again,
list.
It's like Ram Dass becoming nobody. The idea, or these concepts of taking off our spacesuits, removing the armor, things like that.
Yeah, and I think self-transcendence helps us do that. I think this moment, whether it is through meditation or through awe, you know, a walk in nature, or through whichever, through seeing Roland Griffith stand up from his wheelchair on stage, I think those moments of self-transcendence, if we really sit with them, you know, not only from an intellectual or cognitive standpoint, but also emotionally and physically, they can really make a big difference.
And could we talk for a minute about self-transcendent experiences, like as a academic concept? Because I know you got to work with Yaden and colleagues, and I'm a fan of his work and approach and viewpoint on this, both on the hype and the mystical experiences. But like, what are the kinds of self-transcendent experiences? And is the mystical experience one of them that we can measure most, or how do you view it?
Yeah, so there are a few scales out there to measure self-transcendent experiences. I think they can go, they can vary in intensity, and they can vary in duration and in impact. And I think meditation being one of the most popular ones, right? You can also, the notion of mystical experience was, again, coined by William James, kind of talks about this idea, comes from the religious beliefs, right? From this notion of having a bigger deity that you know. And it was interesting because if you think about it, 200 or 250 years ago, if you walked into a church and you smelled the incense or a synagogue or whatever, a temple of prayer, and you saw all these rituals, I mean, you can imagine if you were living out in the fields, and you came in and you saw the sculptures and everything else, that would probably trigger some sort of self-transcendence. So I think researchers are getting better and better at measuring it and what it means and what its impact is. And I think it's still, there's still some mysticism in it as well.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting to me is like, besides these types of self-transcendent experiences, like mystical ones, near death, religious induced, meditative practices, peak experiences in general, there's that sense of awe and love and gratitude we were talking about, the flow state. But besides that, it's like, what are you transcending? I also see this spectrum of you're first transcending your own ego. So you can see not just your egoic limited self view, but beyond that. And then you can self transcend beyond the self to include the other, or you can and see beyond that, see that sense of oneness beyond our human forms, or you can self transcend potentially even more in a different direction beyond space and time. Right. So it's just a fascinating topic to me that, I know it's hard to academically deconstruct. We're talking about ineffable stuff, but I enjoy the exercise.
Yeah. And I think it generates more questions than answers, or at least that has been my experience with exploring this, right? It's kind of, you can go down a very deep rabbit hole that takes you down another rabbit hole. And there's a book I recently read. It's called Notes on Complexity by Neil Thies. I don't know if you've heard of it, but he's basically explaining with science some of the paradoxes that exist and this notion of mind and body being like of dualism and how this idea that's been embedded in so many of us that only what we can measure, only what's empirical, only what's material truly exists can be, I don't want to say disproven, like the word proven is very charged, but I would say it can be challenged even through science, even through mathematical formulas, that there are paradoxes that are inexplicable. And that the material realm answers some questions, but not all of them. And listen, I mean, science is the best way to acquire knowledge humanity has ever known. And still, it will not answer all the questions. And I think self-transcendence is one of those that, you know, we'll have to go beyond science to truly understand it.
I love that, John. You know, I heard somebody, I forget where I heard this, but use the phrase epistemic humility the other day. Like, let's be humble about the way we acquire knowledge and the knowledge that we acquire, because these paradoxes, you know, an interesting meta paradox, I guess, is the human organism's desire for simplicity, clarity, and safety, while simultaneously being insatiably curious about complexity, right? If we weren't curious organisms with a desire to, you know, explore and experiment, we probably wouldn't last at a long time as organisms on this planet. So I'm like you, I'm very grateful for the epistemological technology that is the scientific method. But such an interesting observation that it's really only the questions that are measurable that will yield to a method like the empirical scientific method. And then it leaves wide open so many of these other questions that are hard to observe through a microscope or a telescope or, you know, with tools or with questionnaires. And so, you know, it makes me think of that famous phrase that perhaps psychedelics are to the mind what the microscope is to biology and the telescope is to astronomy, another tool, another way of investigation.
Yeah, and some would even define spiritual intelligence as bringing the material and the spiritual together, like that science meets spirituality. I think that is a scientific ego-based transcendent perspective to have, is we don't know all the answers. We can't explain everything, but there still are these unseen forces at play that we can't yet describe, and maybe one day we will, right?
And you gotta love paradoxes, right? They're so liberating, right? And in the book, Neil Thies talks about the Vienna Circle and how you know, one of the mathematicians using this notion of infinity, there were these formulas that, because infinity is itself a paradox, right? Because infinity, quote unquote, exists, but you can always add one, so it doesn't really exist. So I think it's so liberating to kind of think about the world in these unexplainable paradoxes, because it just shows you that the only things we can really control is our intention and our effort. Everything else, it's really very much uncontrollable. And I think that's a comforting thought for me. For others, I suspect it may not be.
Yeah, well, you know, spoken like a true student of positive psychology, right, John? I think that perspective is incredibly healthy and would help a person navigate some of the more distressing complexity that is present in human life. I'm thinking about a client that I worked with recently who left her sort of religion of origin, right? The religious dogma that she was brought up in, and as a result, felt like she no longer had the clear answers to questions that she once had, right? And for her, that triggered lots of terror and confusion. How do I orient myself in this world? And through, you know, a lot of work, she was able to sort of land on the other side, the side that you're describing, where, you know, instead of terror, instead of fear, instead of frustration or anxiety, the surrendering to the reality of these paradoxes instead created this container of possibility and wonder and curiosity. And it is relieving, right, when you don't have to have it all figured out.
It's funny you say that, Steve, because I was born and raised Jewish, and Judaism is a very complex, not because it's not only a religion, it's also a way of living, it's a way of engaging with the world, and you know, there's so much tradition embedded in it. And I struggle with the concept of God, right? Like I'm not really sure, or at least the concept of God as it is established in the Torah or in the Bible. So I look at people who kind of have this faith, this blind faith in God, and I gotta admit, I'm a little jealous. It's kind of like in the Matrix, you know, I forget the name of the character, but he says, please plug me back in. I just want to eat a steak. So sometimes I feel like I just want to have that steak, you know?
It's kind of ties into what we started talking about earlier with that question of, can you hold it all? Can you self-distance to get into a state of seeing beyond yourself and your fears? And I think that applies in a big way to existential questions. And it's even one of the concepts or principles of spiritual intelligence that people need to develop, is a critical existential thinking, the capacity to wonder about these unanswerable questions without freaking out and losing your shit, essentially, right?
Yes, I love that. And I'm going to share three questions that helped me get through my day and that have been very powerful. And these are all, you know, certainly inspiring positive psychology. And one of my profs, his name is James Pawelski. He works with positive psychology in the humanities. So, you know, philosophy and art and music and, you know, and he gave us these three questions and they just, you know, that I ask myself these three questions every morning. It's new habits, and I think habits are very powerful. The first one is, what am I grateful for? The second one is, what am I proud of? And the third one is, what am I excited about? And these three questions unlock a different mindset to approaching some of these very difficult questions. And by the way, sometimes I can be grateful that I opened the faucet and hot water came out, right? Like, I think we tend to think that gratitude is this big thing that has to come from, oh, I'm grateful that, you know, I won an award, or, you know, I won the lottery. And I think gratitude can be cultivated in such small moments, right? Like ordering a sandwich and saying, it was perfect. Or, you know, or just saying, hey, I just arrived at the subway station and the train arrived at the same time. I am grateful for that. And the same thing with being excited, right? Excited about listening to this podcast when it drops on Tuesdays, or excited about, you know, I don't know, seeing the sunset. Or I think, you know, paying attention to those little things and just recognizing those moments as moments of gratitude or pride or excitement can be really, really life-changing.
Agreed. Yeah. I hope people write down those three questions, you know, skip back a few seconds and write them down. They're simple, but so powerful. What a powerful way to calibrate your day and fill it with wisdom.
Yeah. I love that. I'm going to try them on, Jonathan. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah. And listen, like I said, and you always mentioned this in your podcast, especially a few weeks ago when you were talking about Marty Seligman's work, it may not be for everybody. Flourishing can be tough if you're in a tough spot, right? Like, there is people who deal with very difficult mental health issues. And I'm not saying that we all have the power to answer those questions every day. And even just trying it or bringing them to our attention can be powerful for some.
Yeah, yeah. And with all those important disclaimers in mind, like, I would still not hesitate to recommend trying those on to any client I work with, like, looking for what you're grateful for, even in the, you know, the hardest of times, looking for something you might be proud of and something you're excited about. And even if, like you said, you come up blank some days, that's okay, because you're almost giving an example of a way to occasion many self-transcendent experiences in little or big ways by these habitual practices that can help keep us in that perspective of, like, seeing the self and other and beyond that, or connected to our own spirituality, if you will.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, Reed, this has been a tough year for me. I lost my best friend to cancer, which is, you know, kind of what triggered me to write this paper, to see the existential dread that can come with a diagnosis like that. A person close to me had another difficult diagnosis, and it's hard. Listen, it's hard. It's a battle. I'm, you know, when people say, oh, positivity, just stay positive, just be positive, just take it, you know, I think, you know, that's what we call toxic positivity. I think life can be very difficult. And when we're suffering, trying to find a little bit of meaning in that suffering can go a very long way. And I'm not saying being happy about it or trying to change your emotions or to adapt them or to do exercises that will make you happy and smile and laugh. And I think trying to put it into the big context, I always like to look at this picture called the pale blue dot, which is, you know, are you familiar with the picture? Yeah. And
I love Carl Sagan's quote. Sagan speech. I'll put it on YouTube whenever I need a kick in the pants on my existential perspective.
It's a beautiful way to get a little bit that I would call extreme self-distancing, right? Like we're this pixel in this picture, and this notion that if we can try and find meaning to the things that we can't control, and there are lots of things that we can't control, I would say most of it we can't control, and find a little bit of meaning and try and connect the dots for us. And that's kind of how I kicked off the podcast, with this notion, if you can change your beliefs. And I think our beliefs are kind of the foundation for the meaning that we make of life. And I heard this a lot growing up as a kid, when people said, oh, people don't change. You know, people don't change. People are always there. And I think I heard you say the word, the S word. So I'm going to say, I think that's bullshit. I think we can change our beliefs. I think we have autonomy, we have agency, and it's probably one of the most powerful human skills we have, that and connecting with other people. And if we can leverage that to make meaning and to try and put the things that we endure, into a greater context, that can be quite healing.
Yeah. You know, this whole meaning making thing, I think, is really key. And it reminds me of a quote from Jordan Peterson that I really like, even though I don't like all of his quotes. You know, he says some brilliant poetic stuff. He says he loves to say polarizing things, and occasionally he says stupid stuff, right? But he said once, and I wonder what you guys think, the purpose of life, as far as I can tell, is to find a mode of being that's so meaningful that the fact that life is suffering is no longer relevant.
Well, it certainly makes me think of John's reference to Viktor Frankl and his often cited work around meaning. And I forget which philosopher, maybe it was Nietzsche or something, who said, you know, that if you find a why, you can bear almost any how, something like that. I'm paraphrasing, but... And I really like, John, that you made the disclaimer and caveat to ward us off of toxic positivity, right? Well, we're not saying turn that frown upside down or pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but to, as Reed referenced or has said a couple of times, create this durable, wide, self-compassionate container within which you can hold it all, including the suffering, right? Really getting in contact with the sadness and the grief and the pain, but also don't let that... color or distract you from or obscure the things that are also present, right? The things that we ought to be grateful for, the connections that would be beneficial if we nourished. So really, really important points. So John, I'm curious, any final thoughts? You know, we came a little kind of full circle here with where you started about beliefs. Anything else you want to share from your work?
You brought up the word compassion, and I think compassion is probably, at least for me, it's been the hardest skill to acquire. And I think we throw around the word compassion quite a bit, and it's a very difficult skill to feel true compassion. Requires, you know, I think it requires self-transcendence. It's like, you know, love isn't in its best expression is compassion. So, I think, you know, I'd just like to say, if anybody wants to download my paper, I don't know if we can put it in the show notes or, you know, it's available. Yeah, it's on the Scholarly Commons at the University of Pennsylvania. If anybody wants to read it, I'm very grateful for this space and the time and for the work that the two of you are doing. I've learned so much listening to the podcast, and I hope I could add a little bit of, you know, maybe a thought or two for folks who are listening. And yeah, I'm excited to see where the world of psychedelics go next. I think, you know, they declared the loneliness epidemic earlier this year. And I think there's a lot of folks out there who need the help, and we need to, you know, traditional therapeutic approaches have proven to be effective. The effect sizes of some of the studies coming out of psychedelics are just shocking. In like when you look at the numbers, it's just shocking how impactful this can be on people's lives. So I am hopeful that there's a safe and ethical way to scale this and make it accessible to every single person who may need it, who may be suffering, and who may be able to use, you know, psychedelic assisted therapy as an avenue for healing. So yeah, that's, I'd say that's my parting thought.
Thank you for being here and sharing. I know you put countless hours into your thesis, and it's really fun to see it come together with your life journey, this midlife crisis masters, and what came out of it. I know the topic has got my mind, heart contemplating its place in the universe. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Reed. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, John, I really appreciate you applying your powerful intellect and your articulate voice to this particular issue. And it seems like a self-transcendent experience for you as well, in which you are really helping to elevate others by doing this work. So it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you, John.
Thank you. This podcast was a self-transcendent experience in itself.
Hey, there you go. Yeah, only appropriate for psychedelic therapy frontiers to be psychedelic. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.